Welcome to The Secret Truth. This is George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We're going to have 2 hours of the Transformation of America. This is Transformation America Part 1, Hour 1. And what we're going to do here is we're going to put out some very, very general ideas of what has been occurring in this country. We're going to cover between George Washington and up to JFK assassination. And then we're going to pick up from the JFK assassination on to present times. But what has been occurring is unprecedented in the world's history. This country was founded upon, you know, very, very beautiful principles and ideas. And where we were rebelling against King George, and so the new idea was that we were going to establish a country where all men were kings, but bowed to no king. But we got off on a very good start. We came out of the Articles of Confederation, and we met in Philadelphia for the Constitutional Convention. Before that, there was the Declaration, and so it started off in a very, very good manner. What we have today has deteriorated so much, and many people in the country are beginning to wake up, and we're going to address that in hour two, what wakefulness is, and what does that really mean in the present state of affairs. Getting back to the beginnings of America is that America was founded on very noble and high principles. It did have a believer class there, a believer in God, versus a believer in anything else. So it did have a Christian type base. Some people would argue with that. There were many varied Christian religions. They set out in, you know, the Constitution that there would not be, you know what I mean, in the Bill of Rights, a state religion. So this gave rise to a freedom of speech and freedom of religion in Article 1. Early on, George Washington was warned there was a major meeting over in Wilhelmsbad, which is just out of Frankfurt. And this Congress, it was named the 1782 Congress of Wilhelmsbad. And at that Congress, some would allege an associate of mine, Eric A. Samuelson, a doctor of law, set out on by his hand in November 2006 a brief outline of what that we believe occurred at that Congress. And supposedly, all of the heads of the Freemasonic lodges in Europe were called together and convened there, and a plan was disclosed to them. And we believe now that that plan, after 42 years of study of the subject on my own part and Eric Samuelson's part, we believe that it advocated and put forward a plan of world dominance. We believe the main, you could say, dynamic that was going to be used to dominate the world would be money dynamics. In other words, the banking system was a major key, we believed, to taking over the world and to consolidate that power into the so-called elitist hands. We believe that those plans have been, you know what I mean, passed on from membership to membership through the mystery school and the secret societies since that 1782. And so as a result, we believe that we are under a money power system versus a God-centered type of system. There are biblical scripture that states that you have two things to worship before thee, two gods to worship before thee. You can worship mammon, or you can worship God. And what has happened in America today is that a money system, especially beginning in 1782, was organized. And through materialism and just the greed that we have, because of the human failings, we begin to default on the mammon side. And so men and women and everyone predominantly began to focus in on wealth, worship of wealth. And so that began to be an overriding, yes, we would have our churches and things like this, but also within the churches there was great respect for wealth and big money. So we never really escaped that dynamic. So especially since this Wilhelmbad Congress, the focus has been to build a control mechanism of wealth through modern financial banking and operations. Through interest taking and interest paying, it began to be a dynamic that today has reached a proportional, just great dynamics of control. There, in 30 to 40 years before Jesus walked the earth, there was a change that was put together by the Sanhedrin Council under Halil the Babylonian. And that change was called the Prosbul. Okay? Before the Prosbul, and this would be about 30 years before Jesus, so that would be well over 2,000 years ago. So the Prosbul was put forward, and the Prosbul actually, the setting out of the law of the sabbatical, which was a 7-year period, the sabbatical stated that all debts had to be released at the end of the 6th year, and all slaves had to be released. All debts had to be forgiven. All slaves had to be released, and there could be no money loans during that 7th year. This was strictly law, and it would govern people's actions up to that time. The Prosbul was put forward by the money lenders as a means by which to continue to make loans and continue to collect that debt, those debts during that 7th year, and not force them into release or forgiveness of those debts. So that's a very important concept. I'm going to have it. It's up on our site now if you go to that. If you go to thesecrettruth.com, we're going to have all of these different details up there. And the Prosbul, I'll have a click off where you can go into the Encyclopedia Judaica, and you can get the exact definition from within that encyclopedia. It's spelled Prosbul. But anyway, the Prosbul enable the lenders, the money lenders, to continue to make loans during that 7th year. I'm giving you a little background on this, and then we'll come forward, 1700 years to the 1782 Congress of Wilhelmsbad. But anyway, what that did was override the need then to cancel any debt and so forth, which is very important. Coming forward to 1782 and the Congress of Wilhelmsbad, We get a plan coming out of there, and that plan was to dominate the world through money lending and interest taking and paying, a financial and banking takeover of the world, okay? And the Rothschilds were there at the beginning of this particular Wilhelmsbad Congress, okay? What went on since then was that soon after this, the convening of this Congress, John Robison was quite a scholar and scientist. out of the University of Edinburgh, Robison. And he questioned the Illuminati so-called takeover of Freemasonry at the time. And so in his questioning of this, it caused him to write a book, okay? And in that book, he began to lay down some of the tenets of this, of what they call the Illuminati system, see? And he was a physicist and so forth. He was Scottish physicist, mathematicians. He was a professor of philosophy at the University of Edinburgh. He was well respected, okay, at that time and so forth. And he wrote this book, and it was sent to, okay. It was entitled Proofs of a Conspiracy, 1798, I believe, 1797, 1798, okay. He actually sent that book to George Washington on his thoughts, in which he replied to him in a letter, okay. And it was not the intention to doubt that the doctrines of the Illuminati and principles Jacobitism had not spread in the United States. In the contrary, no one truly were satisfied of the fact that I am. The idea I meant to convey was that I did not believe that the lodges of Freemasons in this country had, as societies, endeavored to propagate the diabolical tenets of the first or pernicious principles of the latter. He was alerting in his letter and his sending of a copy of this book to George Washington at the time, he was alerting him to the infiltration of the Illuminati system into Freemasonry. And so that is a very, very important date in this whole so-called transformation of America. Without that money system having as great an impact as it had, then it wouldn't have the influence. Later, what would be promulgated was the Civil War, the American Civil War. The War of 1812, you could say, was convened after that, with Jackson against the money system. Of course, Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, said that the bankers were more dangerous to America than armies, than standing armies. So he knew the money problem also. But also who followed that was Andrew Jackson, who also had similar views about the danger of the money system to the freedom and liberties of Americans. And he warned, and then we had the 1812 war, and finally we beat them back there in New Orleans and fended off that attack and could try to consolidate our country again and move forward. Well, the next major thing happened. Oh, my gosh, we've got a civil war out there. And the Civil War almost broke the country totally. It divided the country. For decades after the Civil War, what came out of the Civil War was a greenback that was put together during Lincoln's administration and by his Congress. They needed a means by which to finance the war for the North. And so they came up with the issuance of greenbacks, which enabled them to pay for war materials. And so it boomed the war economy in the North, and it devastated the South, because the South did not have the same power to issue. They issued the Confederate money, but it didn't have the same impact of a Congress standing behind it. And the North did have industries at the time, so the greenback that they issued had more behind it. It was still paper, and it didn't have any gold or anything else behind it at the time. But it still enabled it. It provided a specie within the economy of the North during the Civil War to prosper the North and to turn over goods and services. If you don't have enough specie, and that is money, to facilitate the exchange of goods and services, then you're going to have a bidding up of the goods and services because of the lack of specie itself. The amount of specie can determine the pricing in any economy. If there's too much specie, then the prices would be fought over, and that the inflation of the money would ensue as a result. So there has to be a balance. Whenever you're issuing money, and the issuance of money, and especially this was a fiat money, meaning that the money itself was only backed by the credit of the United States Congress and government. But anyway, the greenback was issued, and millions of dollars worth of greenbacks were issued, and this enabled the North to prosper and to buy and enable them to secure the war materials that they needed to defeat the South. And but what came out of that war also was a solid South, Democratic South. After they fended off, the South fended off the carpetbaggers and reestablished their sovereignty over their states, they naturally went and organized around the Democratic Party to regain power in their political states, in their own states, in their own areas, political divisions. So that's why you had this political, democratic, solid South. What developed also that was not good and continued to provide problems is that you still had a South that was still on the slave side of thinking. The slaves were converted more into tenant farmers than they were anything. And so they still barely made a meager living. They just paid them next to nothing, a percentage of the crop and so forth. And in farming, you know, you're going to have an up and down type of economy anyway because of the weather and so forth. There are factors that are not controlled by man. What ensued during this period of the greenback, you could say, was the Farmers Alliance was a lobby group of farmers out of Lampasas County, Texas, and the Farmers Alliance eventually grew to about 5 million members nationwide, and they were lobbying for the continuous. There was a battle over the greenback. The bankers didn't want the greenback, and they wanted to move the country back to an issuance of currency that was controlled by them. So they were against the greenback in the economy, and they would eventually do away with the greenback and institute a gold-backed currency by way of the 1913 Federal Reserve Act. Before that happened, you had the Farmers Alliance that was beginning to gain political power and clout. And so their problem was there was not enough specie in the economy to turn over their cotton. Cotton was king. And so as a result, they needed a certain amount of currency in the marketplace, in the economy, to be able to turn over their product. And then what ensued also was that you had middlemen and cotton brokers coming in. And in this state, in Texas, you had them coming in from Houston, say. And Thomas House, his father, established a brokerage house, a cotton brokerage business in Houston, right during the period when cotton was king, and it was the cash crop of the South during the post-Civil War period. So what happened eventually was that the Farmers Alliance was pushing for financial reform. And they wanted to institute an issue of the greenback by the federal government, but to effect a greater issue so that their turnover of their product would be facilitated by the greater number of specie in the economy. So when that was put before Congress and the nation as a whole, and especially the bankers began to see that this was something that they didn't want. They wanted to do away with the greenback, so they made a concerted effort to create a number of financial panics, and as a result, they persuaded Congress and through money and lobbying efforts to reform the financial and monetary system and banking system in the country. Senator Aldrich, in the early 1900s, had been a senator in Maine, and he represented the money interest. His daughter married John D. Rockefeller's son, and so as a result, the Rockefellers and the Aldriches were married or related through marriage of Senator Aldrich's daughter to John D. Rockefeller's son. So what came out of that was that Aldridge had put forward some reform bills and so forth to establish the central bank. But people saw, and the public saw through that, and they resisted that being done. So as a result, Woodrow Wilson convened a monetary commission, and this was after Senator Aldridge had resigned from the Senate and stepped down because of a scandal that he was involved in with the Senate. So Senator Aldridge is a private citizen, and then he was appointed chairman of this monetary commission, whose duties were to go out and to travel, especially to Europe, and to find out how the Europeans had done their central banks, and bring the best ideas back to America, and then put that forward to Congress and the people as a plan of financial and monetary reform that would help move the country forward. Well, Aldridge and them went all over, Europe, and looked at these other systems, and they reported back to the president. And basically, their report provided and advised that a central bank should be created to move the country forward, and also a gold-backed type of currency. There was a debate at the time between a bimetallic system of gold and silver, or just gold alone. What finally was put together was a system of fractional banking, and it came out of the Aldrich bill would not pass, and so they renamed it the Federal Reserve and put it forward. And finally, the bankers at the time turned their nose up at it purposely and intentionally to give the impression to the public that they didn't want the bill, that they didn't like this Federal Reserve bill, but secretly they were all for it. And they used reverse psychology at the time to finally get the Federal Reserve Act passed. The Federal Reserve is not a public organization. It's privately owned. And that's the problem that we've had since it was founded. So the Federal Reserve bill, and this is one of the things that I must commend Ron Paul for doing. We joined into Charlotte Littlefield and myself, my co-host of this program, joined in with the Ron Paul campaign in 2000, and we started the program in 2006, The Secret Truth, November the 1st, 2006. We'll have been on the air 8 years this next November, but within about 8 to 8 months after that, 8 to 10 months after that, we joined in to the Ron Paul effort. And I remember interviewing Carol Paul in August of 2007 in San Antonio in the Buckhorn Saloon and Museum, I think it's called, down in San Antonio. We now have photographs of some of those times, right during that time when we were standing out in front of the Alamo, I remember so vividly, and we heard Ron Paul's bus was on the north side of the Alamo outside the walls, and then there was a great crowd that gathered around him, and then they marched around the Alamo first to the west, and then as they rounded that corner of the Alamo, the northwest corner of the Alamo exterior walls, they were marching right down in the street, on the street in front of the Alamo, and it was just so overwhelmingly such a powerful scene. I remember Charlotte Littlefield asked Ron Paul a couple of questions. One was about health, and one was about the North American North American Union, and he was against both. And we got that on tape. And then later on, we would go down to this Buckhorn Saloon and Museum. And it was a museum because back in the back corner, they had a Texas Ranger exhibit. And that's where we interviewed Carol Paul, was down there inside of that exhibit. But what Ron Paul's, I must commend him for, and what he really stood tall for was he's been against that Fed for years in Congress, and that's really where we joined in with him. We knew the Fed was privately owned, and it still is, and it still hasn't gone away, and it's still providing billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of credits to foreign corporations and so forth just to save the system itself. But we joined in with Ron Paul because we believe that a great reform through reforming the Fed and having more control through the U.S. Treasury was the better solution than what we have today. But Ron Paul stood very tall. We joined in later with three in the Fed rallies down in front of the Fed Reserve in Houston. And Charlotte and I broadcast three of those. And we have two of those on video. One of those, we had a failure on the broadcast itself. We just had audio on that one down there in Houston 1 year. We had a hard time with the connections. But anyway, standing up against those money changers, so to speak, that idea of collecting interest, and I think Jesus threw them out of the temple. And so that was the way he had of communicating some of the real dire and problems that we have today. Later on, during hour two, the Transformation of America, part two, we'll get into a few more of those money questions. But picking up on this again is that the greenback was defeated and done away with by the banking industry. The Farmers Alliance eventually was moved against, especially in Texas, by the industrial organization that farmed against them, and finally disappeared. And what occurred after that was that the Federal Reserve was founded and began to be the monopolistic issuer of credit. And we're not talking about money itself. Money is still issued and minted by the U.S. Treasury. But the big money, the credits to all the banks and the creation of credit, some would say from out of thin air, has been continually going on since 1913. And especially since 2008, when we had this financial crisis, they've been issuing at a very, very high rate. And so from there into the Depression, you could say that we've had money dominance by the Federal Reserve. Then the Depression itself was a further consolidation of your strongest financial and corporate interest to buy up those weaker corporations and businesses. And so there was a tremendous consolidation that came out of there. Before the Depression, we had World War One. We had the League of Nations, which was another means by which to try to bring, you could say, America under the yoke of an international cartel of elitist, money elitist, and which you could say the Wilhelmsbad was the progenitor of the original idea of a money dominance and a money takeover on an international basis. And so we had that put forward through the League of Nations. The money system, the money elite, the financiers, these are talking about world international financial financiers and so forth, have always used organizations to do their bidding. Much like in their passage of the 1913 Federal Reserve Act, they had many organizations out there that they were funding to do their bidding. But today it has exploded into a tremendous number and a collage of different organizations. In the 1800s, I must bring this in as an important fact here, or an important facet of the dynamic itself, is that if you've ever heard the term Fabian socialist, the Fabian socialist could be described as those Fabian socialists that helped found the Fabian Society in England. And what that was a means by which to slowly bring Britain to a socialist nation, to convert it into a socialist type of nation. And the reason why it's mesmerizing in the fact that the average man will subscribe to a socialist system because they believe that that is more fair, say, than other types of systems. But the elitists of the world are funding, actually, the socialist movements throughout the world, and the direct evidence of the Fabian Society being funded by the elitist of, and the moneyed in England is overwhelming. But basically, the plan is to provide to the common man a more communistic, socialistic type of political system that they can control those people through the granting or denying of benefits and programs. And so that's basically the play on the lower level, you could say, to control people through the granting or denying through benefits and so forth, of the social programs. The upper level has never changed really. And it's a moneyed class at the very top of, you could say, the pyramid where the all-seeing eye is at times. It has a watchfulness, see, of watching people that are in opposition to that money system. So it'll go out and identify those people and it will never finance them or help them get ahead in the economy or the world as a result. But so at the top, what has happened was Giuseppe Mazzini in the 1800s, Italian, fought and worked within the Republican system, okay? But he was a member of the secret societies and mystery school systems. So he actually advocated and founded the original idea of fascism in Italy. And basically what that idea was back then was a partnership between the trade guilds at the time, which were dominant, along with the government. Well, if you take the trade guilds out in today's system and substitute instead your giant corporations, then that's what's happened. So the World Economic Forum is a good example of that dominant corporate group of corporations that have been very dominant worldwide and still dominate. They're bigger than some countries. So at the top, it's evolving into, at the very top, the financial, you could say corporations are still dominant, but they're still being funded by the Fed, but those dominant corporations have had problems because of derivatives and so forth, but they're still dominated by the Fed because of their lending ability, and that's what's keeping them alive today. But anyway, the financial corporations are at the top. Below them are all of the other corporations. But they're acting in a way of corporate fascism more than anything else because they dominate most governments of where they operate in within the countries that they operate. So the corporations are becoming bigger and more dominant than countries that they're located in. Then below that, they're wanting to give at least socialism or into much more of a, instead of a communistic state where the state would own the means of productions, the corporations will still own the means of productions, but the transfer, you could say, of the public resources into their hands would be affected by public-private partnership types of dynamics. You see this at the World Trade Organization Forum in Davos, Switzerland, that's held annually towards the end of January of each year. And they're really pushing the public-private partnership. And what they're basically playing on is they're playing on using the credit of the state, which in some cases is unlimited because of the central banking mechanism, to their advantage. And thus they have unlimited credit to begin transferring those previously public structures and infrastructures and so forth into their own hands. We're seeing them transfer highways and other interchanges and things like that into their own hands. We in France recently, the most popular television station was transferred into private hands, and Henri de Caprice, who is the chairman of the Bilderberg Group, helped affect that. So that's what these people are about, is to, they have an infinite ability to create credits out of thin air through their banking system of credit creation on sets of books, and then they'll go out and start buying up real assets with those credits that have been created. Getting back to America before you could say JFK, is that coming out of World War II, America had spent a tremendous amount of money on that war. So we needed to regroup. We did have a tremendous economic expansion in the 50s and so forth. But there were certain very important bills that were passed in 1947 that would change America forever, and that's the National Security Act of 47. And there they created the CIA and other related organizations that had resulted in the elitist operating from behind a veil of secrecy. And this secrecy thing has been a major negative, and is contributing to the taking over of this country. So that today, more than ever before, the Freedom of Information Acts and so forth are becoming almost impossible to secure the information you want. Either they provide you the material, but it's thousands of pages and you have to pay so much a page, or they stave you off and delay you or stonewall you to where it takes years and years to secure the information that you're looking for. These Freedom of Information Acts, not only on the federal but the state level, and in now cities have to conform to some of that, have been a good investigative tool for reporters and journalists like myself and Charlotte Littlefield. But we see a time in the future that is going to be nearly impossible to secure any information, because the comeback on it is beginning to be that it has national security implications, and we can't release that because of these national security issues on the information that you're seeking. So if there's information that you're trying to seek that would be derogatory towards government and so forth, then they're going to come back with these kinds of responses. And that's becoming a non-freedom of speech issue, and that is dangerous to the very essence of freedom and liberty in this country. These are some of the dynamics that we're beginning to see that are occurring out here that really have been a problem. The idea that we could speak our mind and say whatever we felt like without impending on or, you know, being prohibited by government is being threatened. And we just got to start standing up and trying to, you know, realize this freedom of speech right that the First Amendment guaranteed us, so to speak. But it's changing, and it's becoming very, very, the dynamic of it and the threats to reporters are becoming very real. So we have a new way of approaching this now that we never have had before. And when you're talking about the early part between Washington and say JFK, okay, then you're talking about a limited number of newspapers. And so because of the limitation and the dominance of just a few, you could say big publishers of newspapers and so forth, then the ability to control the press was more effective because you had less people that owned the major newspapers and media. You had an explosion that occurred in the 20th century of the ownership and the production and publishing houses and so forth. But what's happened in the modern era is that those have been consolidated back into fewer and fewer multimedia giants. The essence of what we're talking about here is whether we're talking about from George Washington's day to the JFK era, we're talking about a wakefulness or the inability of individuals to awaken. So what did that really have to do? I mean, what is that really about? Are people truly waking up? Are they still lost in this a mirage of predisposed ideas? The essence of what I believe is going on is that we are born into a family, and that family, okay, that we're born into, we didn't necessarily ask to be born into that particular family, but we find ourselves within a family. And I believe that shortly after birth, you know, much has been said in about this thing called false self, okay? And much has been written about the false self. But in my review of some of those writings in the last few days about the false self, I begin to see that the individual writers, and many are psychiatrists, psychologists, and so forth, are writing as if they're not subject to this false self thinking, see? And so it's interesting in a way that the way I've come to look at this thing called false self, and this is probably a good time for me to define exactly what I'm talking about here, is that the false self that I'm talking about in these broadcasts would occur, I believe, shortly after birth, where you're born into the world and you have, and I believe you're as close to this thing called the true self as you'll ever become shortly after birth. But you're a young child, you're just a babe, and you don't have the intellectual understanding of what is going on yet, and you have no real knowledge of yourself yet, and that slowly develops with the interaction with the family and so forth, and you begin to understand that you are a living being and you're part of this family, and your mom is there, your mother nurturing you and so forth. So it takes a while, but I believe that because the family itself is suffering, I believe, from a false self concept and predisposed situation, and the essence of mode, you could say, then what they're doing is they're passing on, okay, to those children, their young babes, their young children. They're actually inducing into those children the very essence of what they have suffered themselves from. And so, but they're not knowing this. They're unknowing and unwittingly interacting with a child. And I'm not talking about bad families. I'm talking about good parents here. And they're bad ones too, but they do about the same thing as far as these predisposed ideas. And I believe that the predisposed ideas are more abstractions than they are real. And so actually what we're seeing on a large scale and large scale across society at large is an interaction of false selves with other false selves. Now, in my review of these definitions that many people have of false selves, it didn't come across to me that the writers themselves could necessarily say they seem to think of themselves as not suffering in this state. And what I have found in my research and my study of this subject is that as we're children, we're born in the world, we have these parents, we have a family, they're predisposed to thinking of self. We're talking about how we think about self, ourselves. And this idea of I, self, you know, so forth is what I'm trying to define here in a little bit more specific way. Is that we think of ourselves in a certain way, but we have been conditioned by our parents and our families and our society at a very early age to begin to awaken and conceptualize ourselves in the way that most of the societal members have been conceptualizing and thinking of themselves. So it's hard to see because we're beginning to be taken in and we are born into a system, okay, into a feel system. Okay? And that feel system has certain inputs, and the inputs into us from the other members in that feel system have been predisposed by into those people, and then they're actually inducing into us the same ideas of which they have been educated or programmed into. I believe there is a way to overcome that, but you've got to know yourself. Now, that's an easy thing to say, but it's a very, very hard thing to accomplish. The new school would be another concept that I've talked about, and it enters into this wakefulness thing, is that if we can somehow create, instead of creating, you could say, school systems that are out, we still need the basic three R's, so to speak, but also we need to educate people as to why there are schools, see. And the reason why I believe there are schools is that the elitists have created through the Prussian system, the Prussian model, a system of control. They needed a nation, a national patriot soldier that was loyal to the country, but also to the leadership. And in being loyal to the country and to the leadership, and they could condition that into individuals through this education system, then they could go out and fight those wars that would protect the wealth of the elitist. And that's what it's really about, the basic idea of education. Secondly, it's about maintaining a job, capability to educate people into the job that the wealthy and the people control the businesses need, the types of workers. And so it's like a worker bee type of hive mentality that they want to continue. You don't preach freedom and liberty to that hive mentality. Otherwise, you're going to have people that want to be free and not be under the constraints of mind systems and thinking. Thought control is what we're talking about. We're talking about a field system that is heavily on the mind control side of the equation. And being on the side of mind control and thought control, then the field system is real, see. So you're born into the world. You're induced into you are the ideas by the parents and your brothers and sisters or whoever. And so you're forming and there's structure to your thinking. And in this thinking, it's hard to break out of that necessarily. And so as a result, you continue to think in a mode, okay, of thinking that cannot be one of freedom, but instead is one of constraint and so forth. And we must awaken in some other way. We graduate from our families into these schools with the kindergarten or first grade, and what do we find there? But teachers have been conditioned and predisposed to certain ways, just like our parents, and so they continue this process. Only later on through our school system, when we get into maybe a higher education where we begin to think for ourselves, can we ever begin to break away from this predisposed thinking that has us in a bind, okay? To know thyself is all supreme, but can we begin to do that within a system of a condition state? And what I believe that has been induced into us is a delusional mode of existence. And that's the way I describe it, is that the delusion that I'm talking about here is not that we don't see reality like it really is, but that we have an incorrect, an inaccurate view at times of reality. I'm saying that reality is objective. Outside of ourselves, I believe in an objective reality and so forth. But our inability to correctly and accurately define that reality is what keeps us in a delusion, in a delusional mode. Okay, we can't quite put our finger on it and establish a more exact and more accurate view of reality. So we must take some of this that we're unknowing and appreciative of, or knowledgeable of, or not knowing of, or not aware of. We must take some of this on faith, and thus we must rely on certain individuals that we feel that are well respected. You could say authoritarian type authority figures whose judgments that we value, that we have come to value, and then we can try to begin a system of awakening. There are other two things to add to this: is know thy thoughts. And the second thing, like I said, know thy thoughts, is a dynamic of being able to stand outside of your mind and look back on the thoughts that are streaming through your mind and beginning to understand how those thoughts are controlling and how they limit us and control us and constrain us from seeking real truth and liberty and freedoms. So it's an ongoing dynamic situation. This know thy thoughts. The third thing is know thy world that I added. The know thyself is an old Socratic teaching. I added to that know thy thoughts, and then I added a third thing, know thy world. And know thy world has to do with our ability to begin to see the world more exactly and more accurately than we have before. And if we can begin to make a more accurate assessment of reality, then we can come out of this delusion or this deluded state. And so know thy world has two levels. It has one level of interpersonal relationships where we must begin to appreciate true human nature and really the limits and the weaknesses and the strength of that human nature, and make an assessment, an accurate, objective assessment of our own faults, weaknesses, and strengths. But to see ourselves as we really are, and then to accept ourselves. But most of all, we must begin to forgive ourselves and others. And that is the key to coming out of this subjective, biased, predisposed state of delusion, and beginning to understand and see the world more objectively, and begin to not judge it for what the world is, but begin to appreciate the dynamics of the world and the different, you know, varieties of people and the beautiful things of the world, but begin to accept the world, the is of the world. We do this through a dynamic of forgiving. That's why that teaching, it, to me, is all paramount. Is paramount because it's a cult breaker. When I was over in Copenhagen, I would meet with individuals that were maybe 40, 50 years younger, maybe 35 to 40 years younger than me, and I would bring up these different topics and this advice, but I never let one person walk away without giving them the gift of forgiveness. And I would always couch it in terms of, it doesn't matter if you're an atheist or if you're a Bible thumping fanatic, this can release you. This is a cult breaker. It is the greatest gift that you can give to your fellow man. And that's basically the way that I would approach most people. And I spoke about this at our symposium also. I want to thank Farrell Montgomery for helping on that. Boy, he was a big help. Shout goes out to Farrell for helping on this in so many ways. But and Randall Mock and his group, Truth Seekers, want to thank them, and Mary Anderson and Janice and so forth, and all those other people that helped us get over there. Want to Dean and just so many other people, probably leaving out the people that helped us get to Copenhagen, and Gordon Walton and Laura. Gordon and Laura Walton, thank you very much. You've been steady, and you've really supported some of my events and activities. I want to thank you in a very special way. But anyway, we got over there and we started doing our symposium and going down, meeting some of the protesters of the Bilderberg. And this Transformation of America talk, part two, is going to come up here at the beginning of the second hour. And then we're going to take it shortly before, you could say, the JFK assassination to present times, and we're going to be talking about inclusive capitalism and so forth. But getting back to this transformation of America, part one, is that the country has been overwhelmingly attacked. The psychological, the philosophical, the political ideas, the attack on the Constitution, and all of these other things have ensued during that period of when George Washington received that book from John Robinson warning him about the Illuminati takeover until much later today. We have to come out of that system. So wakefulness is the paramount thing that we need to try to get people to do, and it's not easy. The people have been conditioned now, especially in today's world, into a certain state of thinking that is very, very difficult sometimes to communicate with people. But anyway, that's really what we must do. So whatever and wherever you go, extend the hand of friendship. And through that friendship, you're going to bring to yourself and others a greater understanding at a higher level. And I know Ali Damgaard, when he spoke to our group there in Copenhagen, he'll do little kind acts, see, for people. Like he'll go in a restaurant, and the guy behind him, he'll just go ahead and he'll pay his meal. And the guy comes up to him to pay, and they say, well, your meal's paid for. And then the guy will say, well, who did it? And Ali Damgaard always tells the people, don't say who paid for that meal. So these little kind acts, okay, anonymous kind acts can have, according to Ali Damgaard, a great effect. We must awaken people with kind acts and with love for our fellow man. But also, we must give them that gift of forgiveness. And in giving them that gift of forgiveness, we break them out of cults. We break them out of negative, dark thinking that surrounds them and synergistically can destroy them. A number of years ago, I came up with the idea of social synergy. And in November 15th, 16th of this year, we're going to hold a dynamics on evil. The synergy of evil is what the symposium is going to be called, and it'll be at the University of Texas. It might be off campus. We're thinking about off campus or on campus, like we did the Fukushima Solutions Conference. But anyway, we're just in the beginning planning stages of that now, and we'll have a site up here. We have a site up, but we don't have the click-offs in there yet. But anyway, I want to thank each and every one of you out there for listening to this broadcast and for helping us, especially helping us on that trip over to Copenhagen. We did make the trip. We had our ups and downs. We're gathering together and getting edited now, the final video, and so we'll have that up and running here pretty soon for you to view. And I'll tell you the site. Well, it'll be off the Secret Truth site. We'll have that, and you'll be able to get to thesecrettruth.com, come in there and click off on that, and that will get you pretty quickly to the site that'll have our video, and you can order video DVDs off of that site also. So we want to thank you again for listening, and stay tuned in for the hour two, the Transformation of America, part two. Thank you for listening. Be right back.